way down the line, but we can, there's a lot that can be done. And
Absolutely.
so I appreciate
Thanks,
you
Jack.
educating people.
Thanks a lot. Take good care.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore our other shows, visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and subscribe to our podcast. This has been EcoJustice Radio and our show, The Expensive Folly of Carbon Capture and Storage. Thank you to Taylor Brobery for his Bioneers keynote and our guest, Maury Wolfson. And as always, thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at EcoJustice Radio, SoCal350, and my website, Milder Utopia. If you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to EcoJustice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, executive producer and host myself, Jack Eit, co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by the one and only Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
You're listening. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound like a broken record, but you are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Listen, sponsored. Now, become a member now. Become a member not only because everything you hear is straight, everything you hear is the late, everything here is great, but we also want you to become a member because we want you to get in there and put your shoulders next to the wall like we're doing. Help pay some of them electric bills, some of our toilet papers, our napkins, our portable plates, portable knives and forks. But better than that, even for the staff, the guys are working hard here at KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And this is Screaming Jay Hawkins telling you why you got to do it. You got to do it not because it's an order, not because it's mandatory, not because it's a must, but it's because this is the only place where you're hearing the right stuff. You're hearing the truth, you're hearing the good sound, and you're digging people who knows what it's all about. So pick up on a few things and lay down some of them other things and just dig KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And remember, I said so. I, Screaming Jay Hawkins, I ain't walking, I'm talking. I'm squawking. Become a member now. Become a member of KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. I'm about to sign off. Bye. Bye.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
On the next episode of NeuroEmergent, I talk with Leah Blankenship, founder of the Neurodiversity Alliance at the University of Oregon.
Running a group entirely with neurodivergent people, it comes with its own challenges. So much of what defines academic success for these students is just being a successful adult.
Join us at 11 a.m. Wednesday, August 27th for a conversation about neurodiversity from a Gen Z perspective.
Oh. Hi, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and this is Life Stamps, stories from here and there. I'm Joseph.
I am Tyson.
Join us every other Thursday at 10 a.m. as we discuss exciting destinations around the world. They're not always from personal experience, but never without cultural awareness and a passion for travel.
Welcome this week to Life Stamp Stories from Here and There. Got a special guest this week. Actually, my roommate, Talbot Wallace. Welcome.
Good afternoon, or hey, namaste.
Namaste to namaste. You, my friend.
So what's with the namaste? Is what?
It's the way everyone says hello in Nepal, and there's actually no goodbye. It basically means I recognize the God in you. It's a really cool way to kind of get introduced. Cool. So
it means hello and goodbye, but the meaning is I recognize the
all
God
in one.
You.
Yes,
that's beautiful. So as Talbot was saying, we are covering Nepal today. Specifically, the Jomson part, that's Jomson, of the Annapurna Trek in Nepal. So, could you just tell us a little bit about, what is the Annapurna Trek?
Totally. So the Annapurna Trek is probably, my guesstimate would be the most popular trek in Nepal. Mm-hmm. Nepal is famous, obviously, for the Himalaya Mountains, some say Himalaya, 20,000 feet peaks. And they had this network of tea houses. So basically, the natives figured it out a long time ago for all the trekkers and the people who are mountaineering. Hey, why don't we just set up tea houses, these inexpensive lodges, like a guest house, mm-hmm. where folks that are trekking can actually stay with the family, get some dinner there, have a nice place, very, very modest accommodations. Mm-hmm. It's a fabulous way to travel and check out the mountain scenery, and just it's an amazing place to visit.
So it's kind of like you hike for a day between these tea houses that have lodging, and so it's called a tea house, but it's actually like a lodge with like a restaurant and
more or less. Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like guest house, mm-hmm. like hostel hybrid, if you will.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So I remember we were talking before we started recording today, Talbot, and you were telling me about how it almost didn't happen for you because you kind of got sick right before the start of this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So basically at the beginning of the trek, so you do hire a porter. So that's a dynamic of the trek. Mm-hmm. I think they're required now. I did this trek back in 2000. So mm-hmm. it was October 2000.
So this is someone who's taking your luggage to like different tea houses and
yeah.
stuff.
Okay. Yeah, and that's one nice thing with the tea houses mm-hmm. too. I do a lot of backpacking where you carry all your supplies, your bedding, all that stuff, your tent. In this situation, you don't have to carry that, but you do have to have a sleeping bag. Mm-hmm. You do have to have some food, so forth, like on the trail. Mm-hmm. So the porter you hire, they're your guide. They carry all your stuff. They kind of like tell you about the culture. They kind of introduce you to people, mm-hmm. so forth and so on. And at the time, it was roughly about $10 a day, which is just insane. Mm-hmm. Like it's super, super cheap. Super
yeah.
expensive.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so is that just covers the porter part?
Just like their part. You're also, I think you pay for, because it's been 25 years, mm-hmm. I think you pay for their accommodation, which is like $2 or $3 a night, which is ridiculously inexpensive. Mm-hmm. And then give them a stipend every day. And then if you take a train or a bus or something, you got to pay for that as well.
Okay. Right. And then how much does your night stay per each tea house?
Oh, it's $5, including dinner. Mm-hmm. It's just unbelievably inexpensive. I think of all the places I've traveled, I've been to 40 plus countries. I think Nepal is like a top three as far as inexpensive accommodation.
For budget, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Really. Yeah. And then I guess, so you're saying back in those days, in 2000s, roughly it's about $15 a day, if my fuzzy math is correct?
If you're really a hardcore budget traveler, and mm-hmm. there's some of those guys out there, you could probably pull it off, I'd say about $15, $20 a day. Okay. But still, I mean, probably half of almost anywhere else. I mean, India is probably close second or third, maybe.
Right.
I imagine that's got to be considerably cheaper than, say, places like Kilimanjaro or some of these other great trekking destinations in the world.
That's on the bucket list. I'd love to do Kilimanjaro. I haven't done that. I think that's a little more like more of a hike. I don't know if they have a place to stay.
I don't think it's as many accommodations in between. Yeah, I think they're kind of just treks that you.
I
go
think
out
so too. You do the summit.
We did an episode about Kilimanjaro.
We did. Yeah. So, Joseph did all the research on that one.
So, it seems pretty cool. So, where did you start the trek? Like, where did you fly into? To start.
So this was part of my 2000. I did a trip around the world. Back in the day, you can buy a ticket as long as it's in one direction, and you can't backtrack, and you got to set all your destinations up before you leave. So basically, I went all the way around the world in 2000, and I had like 20 different destinations where I'd get off and get on the plane.
Okay.
So prior to that, I was in Israel, and I flew from Israel to India, and then overland from India to Kathmandu, and then from Kathmandu to Pokhara, and Pokhara is kind of the gateway into the trekking area where Annapurna is.
Okay, so did you fly from Kathmandu to Pokhara, or did you take a bus?
Took a very long, hard day bus.
Yeah.
How many hours was that?
I think it was 8 hours. It seemed a little longer. Yeah. Like those buses.
Bus rides could be intense.
Especially that part of the world in the subcontinent of Asia. It's like they're notorious for being kind of rough.
Yeah, I imagine. I'm hoping you got in the evening or whatever, a good time in the evening to get a good rest before you actually started the trek the next day.
Yeah, I think at the time, like, this is way before, like, you book your things before you go. I didn't have anyone booked. I was looking in my trekking agencies. Mm-hmm. Pokhara is like the trekking capital of Nepal. So you just show up, you kind of dig through your Let's Go, your Lonely Planet, look at agencies that are reputable, do some research, and kind of shop against, figure out which ones are the best ones. I came across one, and I'm so glad I did, because the gentleman, his name was Indra. He's a young guy trying to start a family, and he worked really, really hard, and he's just an amazing individual, because they just carry your stuff, and they take care of you. I think Tyson was asking about the first day. I told him a story about that. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was going to happen, because it's a 10-day trek. Mm-hmm. And this version is you go all the way to Jomsom, and then you fly back home instead of circumventing the whole mountain range, right? Mm-hmm. The first day, within like an hour of hiking, I started getting what's like the belly and the traveler's diarrhea.
Okay.
All at once.
Oh, no.
And in this point of my travels, I was 6 months in my trip, so I was like, I can't believe this happened, because I haven't had that happen at all. So basically, it all hit me at once, and we were like, I don't know, like maybe 5 miles into the trip. Mm-hmm. And I was like, is this going to be the next 10 days? Because I'm not going to survive this.
Oh, yeah, man, yeah. I mean, that's just like the only thing you can think about.
And stuff, yeah.
Because you're walking, you know, 10 miles a day.
And when you got to go, you got to go. And it's not fun.
It was coming from both ends.
Yeah.
So, oh, God.
My porter, Indra, stepped up, and he really proved how much he earned my trust that first day. Uh-huh. And he stepped up, and we were at some village, and he basically asked like 4 or 5 villagers if I could use their bathroom. Like within the first few minutes, I was like, all right, well, this guy is a good guy. He's really taking care of me. I'm feeling confident about this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's so important to have someone, especially if you have a guide, like you feel like they're taking care of you.
Yeah.
Especially because you're in a foreign
place. Do you think it was just like a stomach bug or the water or what?
All the above, especially in Nepal and India. Although I was a vegetarian for 2 or 3 months in that part of the world. Yeah, you just never know. Like new bacteria is being introduced all the time. It could be anything.
It could be anything. Yeah. You're not used to like, you know, the local bacteria and everything.
Totally.
So I'm guessing it wasn't like that for the rest of the trip.
No.
That you got over it.
No, eventually. It was the first day. It was like, it was really rough. Mm-hmm. And I'm a pretty experienced traveler and backpacker. I was like, let's cross our fingers. I was like, I can't do this for 10 days in a row, but let's see how it goes. I kind of, you know, bared down and kind of climbed up, and then after that, it was all great. It was awesome.
Nice. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, probably the best because I took a whole year around the world. Uh-huh. I would say those 10 days, I was reminiscing, going through the photos earlier today, probably the best 10 days of the entire trip.
Wow.
Bar none.
So you started your trek in, what was the town called again?
Pokhara. Yeah.
So you started in Pokhara. And so then what was, what was the cadence like? Like how many hours would you hike between each settlement.
There's a circuit, and I printed up the map because it's been a while since I've seen it. Mm-hmm. But basically, it's like roughly about 10 miles a day, so about 4 to 5 hours. Okay. And it's pretty paced, and there's days where you can cut it a little short, but you got to make up for it the next day because your end result is Mulkdonath, which is like near Jomsen, and it's basically a Buddhist temple that everyone wants to visit because it's really just mystic, and it's in the middle of nowhere, and it's got a natural spring. It's really cool.
What's in this case, your whole trek probably covered about 100 miles through the Himalayas then?
Yeah, I'd say that's probably about accurate.
What's the elevation gain like?
Oh, it's every day is like a different day. Mm-hmm. Like I've done the Inca Trail as well, so it's kind of similar in that design where like you go over passes and it's not as extreme. Like the last pass you actually miss, which is called the Thungrog Pass, Thungarla. Excuse me, my Nepalese is a little rusty.
It's all good.
so that's 5,400 meters. So times, you know, 3.5, whatever, it's insane how tall that
16,000 feet, roughly, something.
Yeah. So it would go from, like, I think Pokhara is right around 6,000 feet, maybe. That's my guess. So basically go from 6,000 feet to about 12,000 feet.
Okay.
Not daily, but, like, I would say, like, in that range, probably 2,000, 3,000 a day.
So tell me now, was this
pretty substantial.
Was this the first?
But you're not carrying your stuff, which is great.
Right, yeah, for sure.
Right.
I'm sure you have, like, a day pack, though, right?
Of course, yeah. Water.
Was this the first trek you've ever gone on?
Of that kind of sort, yeah. I've done a lot of backpacking trips, you know, living in Oregon and so forth and traveling and stuff. But that was the first kind of like official trek I think I've done. Yeah.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So,
loved it. Yeah.
2000 pretty much was like getting your feet wet for the first like real, like long multiple day trek.
Yeah. I've done one, I think in New Zealand was the Kepler trek. That was like 4 or 5 days. That was like 3 months later. And I was talking about the Inca Trail as well. Mm-hmm. There's probably 2 or 3 other ones I can't keep in mind in South America. I forget.
So what really stood out to you on this trek? Like you said, it's like the most memorable time of your round the world trip. Like what made it so amazing?
I just felt like on all levels, it was just so high on so many levels, and figuratively and literally, because the elevation is just nuts.
Right.
But just the people, the kindest, most generous, like authentic people, everyone smiled, everyone said namaste, everyone looked you in the eye. You don't always get that as a traveler. Also, like, I just felt like culturally, because I'm kind of into Buddhism as well. There's a large Tibetan Buddhist refugee camp there spread throughout the Himalaya. So there's a huge influence on that. So lots of monasteries to see that, you know, someone hasn't been there for a few years. It's just all these dusty books and you check it out and some monk lets you in. It's just on all levels, and also the hot springs were amazing, and the trail itself. I mean, just checked all the boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So did you partake in any of the hot springs along the trek as well? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like I think the third day, there's a really nice hot spring. That's right. Everyone goes at night.
What was the weather like?
It was awesome. It was like, it was in October. Mm-hmm. And the big part of going to Nepal, I think I was talking to Tyson about this earlier, is you always want to miss the monsoon. The monsoon, because it hits all of Asia, all of Southern Asia, and the subcontinent, and Thailand, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't never want to be there. Like I would say, I think up till September, and then October is when the weather changes.
Yeah,
I was there.
It's
in
a
late
bit drier.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's like the sweet spot.
And is it because you're higher in elevation? Does it get chilly at all?
Oh, it definitely gets cold at night.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. They have the fires going and everything, like in the tea houses and heat. And stuff.
So I'm sure the hot springs were like so nice. Oh, yeah, perfect so weather for that, totally. Right?
Especially after a hard day of hiking.
Yeah,
it was awesome.
So I'm guessing lunch was always on the hike, breakfast probably when you would leave a tea house, and then dinner at the next tea house that you would arrive to.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, in that order. Like and that's part of the draw to it. The tea houses, you meet other travelers, get tips. It's kind of like staying in a hostel. You kind of like just kind of meet everyone there. It's great. And then also, like, you don't have to carry all that food, because anyone who's backpacked can tell you that, you know, that adds up with weight and planning and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
And this tea house is, you're like, okay, well, next village, let's go grab something to eat. And you'd ask your porter to find you one. And they're like, okay, I know this family. This is a nice place. You should go there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. That's really cool. So you pretty much literally get the local's recommendation and get to take your pick.
It's the best of all the worlds.
Each village.
Cool.
That's really cool. That's awesome. So I thought it would be more like a cater deal. So, like, it was just part of, like, you know, like a cruise itinerary or something.
It's not a service kind of thing. Like, and that's part of why I like it. Was the adventure, it was less like you're traveling on the fly, but it's also like you have options too, so it's not like it's super intense and difficult in that way.
So what was what was the food like? What would you have for breakfast?
There's the American breakfast, uh-huh, that's pretty, and then you remember the English breakfast,
uh-huh,
that they had
hangers
a lot?
And
so they catered to a Western tourist. Okay,
yeah,
I
totally
see.
And then everyone's favorite was pizza, because uh-huh, it's one of those things, like, don't get me wrong, like Nepalese food is great, but I mean, just like Indian food, like after a while you're craving your familiar.
Right. Right. Yeah. So then you're like, oh, pizza.
Pizza is very popular.
So you have like a typical sort of Western breakfast.
Totally.
Probably
mix it up for lunch.
For dinner. Okay. So, yeah. And then for lunch, like, would they pack you a lunch?
You could stop at a tea house.
You stop. Okay.
Same kind of thing. Uh-huh. And then, and a lot of times.
So you're passing places on the way, mm-hmm, too?
Yeah. Oh, little villages. And a lot of these villages, the only way they have, I was going through the pictures earlier, is having yaks and also like, horses and so forth, mm-hmm, bring their supplies in, so you're walking by those as you're going up and down the trail. So it's like their highway, their human highway, so to speak.
Yeah.
And you go on these bridges that are like basically like you're looking down and it's like half a mile down. It's just ridiculous.
Wow. So these little villages, in a way, then, with like the yak transport, do they all kind of do like a little farmer's market kind of deal or whatever, transporting goods to
totally,
so like all the locals in those villages can buy this
that's how they got their supplies, was they're walking the same trail as we were. I'm sure nowadays they fly it in, or they have other like depots, like where they, you know, they have buses now,
mm-hmm,
might be more developed. I'm guessing in 25 years it's probably much
they
more
probably
developed.
Have a highway now or something.
Something, unfortunately. They're probably gentrifying as we speak.
Uh-huh. sure. So
getting a new coffee shop.
Yeah, some Starbucks has been moved in.
Microbrewery.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that would be okay.
Just kidding. Right. So coming back from the early 2000s, how many people would you say were on your trek when you were hiking? I imagine people split off at different points.
Yeah.
But
I mean, as far as overall, I think you had to get a permit. I think they do regulate that, so they do kind of keep track of who's on. But it's not like, I don't think I knew how many account it was. My guess is probably there's like 100 people kind of going in the same cluster.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd run into same types of people, but it wasn't as like where you have like large groups of people. It's more like, oh, there's a group there. I saw them the other day.
So when you have your guide, is that one guide for a group of people, or is it just your own personal guide?
Yeah, porter is just for you.
Okay,
and
I see.
And sometimes people would split up a porter and have like, you know, a couple who have a porter or so forth.
I see.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be like a porter is leading like a group of 10.
Nope.
It's just one person.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, and he'd be your personal guide too.
Wait, so then the porter is carrying your stuff?
Yep. Most of it.
Oh, gotcha. So you're paying this person, because in my mind I'm thinking like, oh, they're transporting it like by vehicle to the next town, but no, this is just like you just give your backpack to the porter.
Your own personal Sherpa.
I see.
Yeah, and you know,
but they're trained.
Tourism was such a big, you know, like economy in Nepal, mm-hmm, and that part of the world. I mean, obviously with mountaineering too.
Mm-hmm.
So like they do that for four or five months, and they make all their money and they go back to their villages where their families are and so forth. You know?
Right. Okay. I see.
One little interesting tidbit too. I was looking at the pictures from the trip, because all the tea houses have names and signs and so forth. I was showing Tyson, like, I was traveling with another friend of mine too, and I'll tell the story of this later.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, the males in Nepal, they only have a selection of three different names, and this may have changed or not, mm-hmm, but it's Indra or Chandra. And we were going by some tea houses, and basically we saw the Indra tea house and the Chandra tea house.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like one of those funny things. That,
you're right. Is it Bob or Jack? Right.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know why that's the case in Nepal, uh-huh, and it's probably changed. Obviously, it's been a long time, but
uh-huh,
just one of those little quirky things where you're like, oh, that's interesting. Okay, all right, cool. Yeah.
So what was your porter's name?
Indra.
Indra.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was kind of talking to Tyson about this as well, the story of how I met my traveling companion as well, which is mm-hmm, really cool. And I think kind of like ties into the whole like why I feel Nepal is such a special place.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different level. And like if you kind of touch into it, or you kind of just focus in on it. So let me go back into my story, how I met my my traveling companion. Mm-hmm. So when I was in Kathmandu, I just came out of a like 5-day silent meditation retreat. Mm-hmm. And I was really just dialed in. I haven't talked to anyone in 5 days. Mm-hmm. And I was going by an ATM. I remember when I first arrived in Kathmandu, trying to use the ATM, it didn't work. And if you travel a lot, you know, ATMs are just kind of iffy. And I was like, you know, I know a bank around the corner I had to use. So something inside of this little voice said, you need to go help that couple. Because mm-hmm. you had a problem with that too. So go help them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even think about it. I was like, okay, I'm going to go help this couple. Mm-hmm. And I walked up to him, and the guy was like, Talbot? He was friend. Yeah. He was
someone you knew.
He's a buddy I met in Israel like 3 months prior. And granted, this is before Facebook and so forth. And like, you know, you take emails, but you don't check your email every day or whatever.
You're not like, oh, I'm going to be here at this time. And then you guys are like coordinating it and stuff.
Not to mention, this was in Kathmandu, right?
This is in Kathmandu. That's
wild. Which probably had what, like 2-3 million people?
It's a very large city.
Right. It's not like it's just a small village that you, like you're running into
it's
him.
It's insane. So,
same ATM,
totally. So, and also I would have walked by him if I didn't listen to that little voice in my head.
Right.
So basically, like, rewind to 2 months before, I met him in Israel at a hostel in Jerusalem, and we went down to, I think I went to Masada, and he went to some kibbutz off the Dead Sea, and I remember he was like, oh man, I'm going to Nepal, I'm going to India, let's connect, and I was just in this whole, like zone, you know, the zone of travel where you're just like, everything's like flowing.
Yeah.
I was like, you know what, man, I'll just see you down the road. I just remember this specifically.
Yeah.
And then lo and behold, fast forward 2 months later, I run into him and his sister, and we start talking. He's like, I can't believe you said you're going to run into me. I can't believe this is happening.
Right.
And I was like, I kind of can't believe it, but yeah, you're right. And then they were going to the exact same place I was going to.
Oh, okay.
So basically they took the trek with us.
That's so cool.
I had my porter. We took the bus down there. We hired the same porter company or so forth. Mm-hmm. And we went on the trip with him and his sister, and it was just the best 10 days.
Wow.
It really was. Because also a lot of it has to do with the people.
That's so cool, because like you weren't planning to have a travel companion, right?
Not at all.
It's just, you know, you saw him and it just kind of all worked out.
I also think that's like really wild, because, you know, you're talking about like several nations, countries apart from where you met him and his sister. I don't know if you met his sister when you were in Israel, but at least when you were in Kathmandu, now in Nepal, you met him again and stuff.
It's crazy, because it was meant to happen. It's also like, I think if you tune out a lot of the stuff, you know, like the noise around you, and like pay attention, and I think that's part of the meditation. It was a Buddhist meditation retreat where I didn't talk for 5 days. I was just really tapped into it, and that voice, I don't know where the voice came from, but it told me that you got to help those people because you just had the same problem. So that's really cool. So it really set the stage for the magic.
Very serendipitous. Yeah. I mean, it just feels like that was something magic. You know, you're coming out of your retreat, so you're like all in the, you know, zen state of mind.
Totally.
And then it's like, you know, you weren't even thinking about talking to this person, but then you're like, I think I should. I totally understand that kind of moment where it's like you do something and that just changes everything.
Because
you could have walked past.
Yeah.
And you could have just done the trip by yourself.
Yeah.
And then, you know, maybe you would have seen him, maybe you wouldn't have, but
it might have been different. We wouldn't be talking about this now. It might have been a totally different trip, you know?
Yeah.
It makes me wonder if our brains were actually stronger muscles before smartphones. You know what I mean? Because now there's so much distraction. So it's like there's a device that tells your brain what to do.
Right.
When before you used to have to force your brain to do something.
I feel like because you probably notice things like more, you know, like you're more aware because you're like, you're paying attention to the details around you.
Yeah.
And I notice that sometimes when I have, you know, if I'm out somewhere, I'll like consciously, like I'm going to put my phone away and then I'm forcing myself to like look at my surroundings and stuff. But if I'm just looking at my phone, I'm totally oblivious of, you know, everything that's happening around me.
I think you guys are hitting on it in a few different ways too. I think also like this is 2/3 or halfway through my around the world trip, traveling solo the whole time.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've done a lot of traveling. I know Tyson has by yourself. Mm-hmm. It's a different dynamic.
Right.
Because I think you have to deal with your environment. Your senses are a little peaked. You meet more people. You don't have a buffer with you.
Right.
So especially on top of that, going to a meditation retreat where I didn't talk.
Yeah.
Because I'm not like, when you're talking to someone, you're thinking about, okay, what am I supposed to say in response to what he's saying?
Mm-hmm.
But when you stop that, you're really just tapping into what's going on.
Right.
So I don't know. I'm not that much of a mystic, but
yeah,
I was vibing on that.
I feel like, you know, there's something there, you know, like even if it's something subtle, like a very subconscious level of like,
totally,
you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so if you're just tuning in right now, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. This is Life Stamp Stories from Here and There. And we have Tyson and I have a guest today, Talbot. And he's telling us about his trip on the Annapurna Trek in Nepal. And we were just talking about the serendipitous moment where he ran into a fellow traveler that he met in Israel earlier on his trip around the world. So yeah, that's super cool. Yeah, did so, I don't know, like...
Well, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead,
because,
Tyson.
Because you were just kind of talking about the whole spiritual experience, mm-hmm, of the meditation and stuff and feeling dialed in. So that just kind of wanted me to ask you, like, one of the bigger, like, you know, personal questions is, like, mm-hmm, how do you feel trekking changes a person?
Mm-hmm. Trekking, per se?
Yeah.
I see it personally as my meditation a lot of times. Mm-hmm. Like, I love backpacking. Like, I just went backpacking a few weeks ago, mm-hmm, and I feel like we were just talking about getting the smartphone away from me, you know,
right,
not watching TV, not like those are nice distractions and we all do it. Mm-hmm. But the less you do that, like you, it's really a form of meditation where you really get in touch with yourself.
Right.
And then you really tap into your own like personal rhythms, mm-hmm, and you're kind of like, you really kind of ruminate on like what life is about and what things are important. And I get my best thinking done without a doubt when I'm hiking.
Yeah.
I think like there's the old traveler, like quote, you know, fear is the mind killer. So embrace, mm-hmm, your fear.
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
something like this.
I think that was a Jedi. Oh,
was it? Okay.
Well, it was maybe a Jedi, Yoda.
But Jedis are still travelers.
Oh,
so.
Most definitely. They're old school travelers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure.
So, yeah.
But I mean, totally relate to that. Like the whole, like, yeah, walking, like in a forest, hiking, like it just like, I feel like it's the totally. Same way. Like I just get my, you know, I think a lot, I process a lot of things and just like, you know,
I come back refreshed and renewed and just like, I'm ready to hit it. I feel just like, I think everyone needs to find some sort of, like, it doesn't have to be meditation per se. Like, mm-hmm, I'm a crappy meditator.
Yeah.
I mean, I've gone to retreats and try to sit down and, like, meditate. Mm-hmm. I can't do it. Like, I try to, like, because you're trying to think about nothingness, right?
Right.
That's not so easy. Get your brain to settle down.
Yeah.
But whatever works, walking, hiking, mm-hmm, sports, it doesn't matter. Find whatever works for you, whatever your passion is, to get you dialed into that. Because I think that's something that people forget to do.
Yeah.
It's like self-care, you know?
Right.
I was listening to a YouTube video with the sound bowls last night, and that, mm-hmm, was kind of nice.
Oh, yeah, totally.
The sound bowls?
I got one.
Yeah, sound bowls are super fun.
But the problem was, because it was on YouTube, it kept my phone on, so it was bright. And so it's like, defeated the purpose, because I was like I could close my eyes, but every time I would just kind of be like,
you could see the light from your phone,
right? I guess like what I'm trying to say,
you gotta turn your phone upside down.
Anything I tried, it was just too bright, and then it was a reminder of artificial light.
Yeah,
that, like, did not help.
Like, was your room dark, and then you just had the oh, I see.
Exactly. Yeah.
So. I have a sound bowl I bought in Poker, actually, in Nepal, that if you want to borrow it and check it out, I'll show you how to use it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
really
cool.
Yeah, it was cool. See, I found some YouTuber that just does really long meditative sound bath.
It's a great, it's a great form of therapy. It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
So, and then the other thing, we were talking before at our house and stuff that, you know, a little bit about like, Nepalese Buddhist folklore, and you were explaining to me a little bit about gods and stuff.
Oh, yeah. So, we do have like one of my most prized possessions is a tonga, mm-hmm, which is basically, it's hard to show because we're on the radio. But basically it's Tibetan, like, cause they believe in reincarnation. So, mm-hmm, it's the wheel. It's kind of like the monster looking guy, mm-hmm, and he's got a wheel in front of him. Mm. So like basically that's, the wheel of reincarnation, and it's, mm-hmm, and like the inner parts, like the seven deadly sins that kind of drive the wheel and kind of keep it spinning.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's a big part of Tibetan Buddhism. And I feel like, I wouldn't say I'm a Buddhist per se, but I have those proclivities where I'm attracted to it. Mm-hmm. And it's almost more of a philosophy than a religion in my estimation, mm-hmm. because it really breaks down the way your brain operates.
Mm-hmm. Like, and is this similar to like Shambhala teachings, where it's kind of like void the human spirit of human desires, mm-hmm. the material plane type of thing, try to get more centered with the overall experience of life?
Yeah, it's, I feel like it's, because it has some semblance with that. I feel like Tibetan Buddhism's really focusing on like nothingness, because mm-hmm. because life is suffering,
right?
And once you realize like you're going to suffer no matter what you do, and mm-hmm. kind of get over yourself,
yeah,
that's kind of the thing, right? That's like the trick,
right? Because I mean, so much suffering just comes from your own self, you know,
exactly,
your own
aspirations,
perception of things, yeah.
Wants, needs, sloth, mm-hmm. yeah. You know, like if you look at the inner part of the Tanga with the circle, mm-hmm. like those seven deadly sins, right? That
yeah.
keeps it driving. So that's all inside of you.
Yeah.
So if you learn like, hey, life is suffering, and like just get over it and figure out, I mean, it's easier said than done, obviously,
right?
But if you just figure that out on a certain level, I think it shortens your emotional reactivity to it.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is like the key.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, definitely. Because you don't have the expectation. The
yeah.
expectation is sort of yin yang in that sense, I guess.
100%.
Here's an interesting question. Was there a moment when you felt like giving up during your trek?
That first day when I was like,
yeah, definitely.
That, oh yeah, I was like, what the hell am I doing? I'm in Nepal. I'm throwing up and doing number twos.
This feels bad.
Yeah,
this is crappy. No, no
literally.
Pun intended.
Yeah.
And also, here's a little fun fact too. I don't know if you've been to India, like where they have squatter toilets, so no toilet paper.
Oh, I know. I'm very proud of squatter toilets. Yeah.
Yeah, good times.
Yeah, yeah.
So like the best is like when you're throwing up and you're trying to bounce over a squatter toilet.
Oh God. Uh-huh. Yeah. Never.
I don't think we need to get too descriptive there,
yeah,
but
yeah, I've used them. But I haven't used them in that state.
I see my question struck a nerve.
yeah. They're supposedly more ergonomically uh-huh. correct, but you know.
Okay, so
right, it's more natural for your body.
So we covered the worst thing that you had to look at during uh-huh. the whole trek. Now, mm-hmm. what are some of the most amazing things that you saw during the whole trek?
Oh, that's easy. Those mountains, I mean, the Himalaya. I think you have 6 of the 10 tallest mountains in the world in that range. And then also like just the Tibetan Buddhist colony, like the refugees and the little camps and stuff, and just the monasteries are just really approachable. Like I said before, you can go hiking and like my porter be like, you can go to that monastery, no problem. And you knock on the door and it, like you have a Tibetan nun who probably hasn't seen one in few years,
mm-hmm.
opens the door and there's this amazing, you know, Buddhist like temples inside.
Wow.
And
wow.
just it, nothing prepares you for that.
Yeah.
So, and that's the other thing, like these monasteries and stuff, are they just like wood fire heated, like
yeah.
wood stove heated?
Yeah, there's a lot of that coal. Mm-hmm. I think they use coal.
They use coal
okay.
as well.
Yep.
Okay, that really paints a picture. It's mm-hmm. like probably really echoey, acoustic-y, and
totally.
the chanting and stuff.
Yep.
That's pretty wild. And then you were talking about some crazy suspension bridges to me earlier and stuff that you
oh,
had
yeah.
to cross through some
oh,
ravines
yeah.
and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, because I think you're going across the Kali and Gandaki River, which is like the deepest river gorge in the world.
Wow.
When I returned back to Kathmandu, I had a few extra days and I actually did the whitewater rafting trip on the Kali Gandak. I think it's Kali Gandak.
Cool.
And it's rated number 2 in the world after the Zambezi in Africa.
Hmm.
So class 5s everywhere. And like it's the deepest gorge in the world, and you're doing foot bridges that are like held up by metal suspension. You're just like looking down and you're like, that's
right.
a mile
super
to
swingy,
my
like,
death.
Right.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah. So what were the stars like at night?
You're at a super high elevation, so you feel like you can just kind of reach out and grab them.
Right.
It's just so
was
much
it
closer.
Pretty clear the entire time?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Yeah. No, not cloudy.
Yeah.
Nice. And then you got the
didn't rain once
frost cover nice. Once you got to a certain elevation and stuff within the trek, I imagine.
A little bit, because I think this part of the trek is a little more advantageous for a little easier weather. When you pass like the 10th day and go over that huge pass I was mentioning, the Thralong Pass,
right?
That's a little more like kind of gnarly, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
and the weather, like someone was like said they got stuck up on the pass, like people die up there.
Okay.
But like it's it's I think it, what we say 16,000 feet earlier, so it's a challenge, and mountain altitude sickness is a thing too, so you got to like prep yourself.
Did you
that.
Experience any of that?
Oh yeah. Not extreme. But the idea is like if you feel it bad, like you feel like sickness or you feel like your head.
What does it feel like typically?
It's a horrible headache.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like being hungover.
Oh,
okay. Bad.
Wow, right. And you're like, I don't know why I feel like this.
Typical
altitude sickness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One little trick you can do, and I did this. I remember someone told me about this trick, which makes sense. Take aspirin for like 5 or 6 days prior because it thins out your blood.
Okay.
So it's like the pro tip.
And that helps with the altitude sickness.
Yeah, because it preps your body for the lack of oxygen that you're going to have because aspirin thins your blood.
Was there any other preparedness that you did before you started the trek, especially being your first time?
I was 26-ish, so I was in pretty good shape at that point. So anyone does that kind of like hiking, I mean, it's pretty intense.
Yeah. I mean, you're doing like 10 miles a day, right?
Yeah.
So, and that's like a 2,000 foot elevation gain. Some days. Which is, I mean, that's pretty substantial. Like,
yeah.
To do that once, it's like, okay, it's fine. Yeah. Like I did that a couple, like a month ago.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, to do it like every single day, it sounds like it can be, you know.
You get used to it. And also you pace yourself because I think the design of the trek keeps that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So not every day was like that. That's okay. Like one of the worst days. There's like 3 or 4 days like that. But there's a few places like, northern past Multanath. It's called the Mustang Valley, which is probably the most remote area of Nepal.
Mm.
It's very different kind of. Biome like eco area, totally way drier and way like less rain. It's in the rain shadow of the Himalaya. So like Nepal is on the southern part and basically gets a lot of rain, and then that part is on the back end, so it's totally different environment. Like it's like this Kembeni was this crazy fort, super dry. And I think that's where like I saw some discovery thing about the bees, and there's the salt miners in that area.
What do you mean the bees?
There's like this bee colony that these Tibetans and also Nepalese were using ladders to keep care of the bees. It's a really cool like documentary.
So this is like a massive bee colony.
Yeah, it's just crazy because they're up on these huge ladders in these caves, and you're like, why is there a bee colony there?
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
Why torture yourself? That's why life is suffering.
Yeah,
right.
That is the efforts you got to make to get like fine honey.
Yeah, the best honey. Yeah, maybe
the simple things in life. Right.
Right.
And salt was a big thing too. Like, have you had Himalayan salt, like the pink salt?
So
that was a currency back in the day, so a lot of salt came from that part of the world, so like they use that.
Gotcha.
Totally
interesting.
So does all Himalayan salt that we buy in the U.S. does that actually come from Himalayas?
That's a good question.
I'm
yeah, I have
yeah,
no idea.
I've
never seen it till recently.
Yeah,
it always seems to be the exact same salmon colored pink.
Yeah,
and everything
like pink.
So
salt, yeah,
it's probably pink number 8 or something.
No, I mean
just kidding.
Right.
You never know. I mean, stranger things have been unearthed and become complete scandalous, especially with our loose FDA regulation in our country.
Yeah, just make it sound exotic, and then it's like everyone wants it, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much time we got left, Joseph, but I mean,
we've got about, I'd say, 15-ish minutes.
Okay. Maybe we'll talk to Talbot for about 5 more minutes and then do some Nepalese trivia, which I imagine Talbot will be an expert in.
Cool. Yeah 20
good.
Years removed. Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So let's see. What's a quick question? Oh, I know what I want to ask you. So you've been on a couple treks in your life now. This was your first one. You also did the Inca Trail in Peru.
Yeah.
What other treks do you have?
Oh, I did. So I did Torres de Paña in Chile and in the Patagonia there. That was interesting because basically that was in March of 2020, and we all know what happened there.
Yeah, right.
I almost got stuck in Chile.
Like, oh no!
Literally, yeah, that was pretty nuts.
Wow.
It was a 5-day trek.
What would you have done if you had gotten stuck?
I thought about it.
Hang out in Chile. Yeah.
Well, I mean, a lot of worse places to be than Chile, right?
Right.
It's a beautiful place. and that was my first like dad trip because I had all these miles. Mm-hmm. But basically, like it's a 5-day trek.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in Chilean Patagonia, and mm-hmm. it is a wilderness, but it's kind of like they have these huts and they also have camping, so you bring in your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just crazy because the pandemic was coming. No one has a hey, this is what happens. This is what you do.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows what to do.
Right.
We haven't experienced this before. Right. It's all new. And so basically 2-3 days in, I would pass travelers and be like, people were like, I think this place is closing. You need to get out. And I'm like, what do I do? Do I turn around? It's 2 days back the other way.
Right.
So it was just nuts. So basically I had to call on a satellite phone to United Airlines to get my flight rearranged and then mm-hmm. hop on two 5-hour buses back down to the tip and fly back to Santiago.
So did you cut your trip short?
Yes. I was going to go to Argentina and go up to Fitzroy and do that area as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think off the top of my head that the glacier nearby. But yeah, they cut off the buses into Argentina during COVID, when COVID hit,
because
each country had its own agenda and how they handled it, right?
Right, yeah.
I think Argentina was probably one where aggressively, like, we're going to shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So they shut down the buses. I was about to get on the bus that morning to go to Argentina, and I'm glad I didn't, because I definitely
would have been stranded, right?
Without
a
doubt.
Yeah.
And also, it was a 5-hour bus ride across. There was no going back.
Mm-hmm.
And then so basically, I hightailed it back, and then flew back into Santiago. And I told this to Tyson before, like, hopped on the plane, and literally when I'm on the plane, the pilot's like, "Congratulations, you're on the last plane out of Chile."
Right. Yeah.
The last plane. Wow.
And I was a hostel manager.
Yeah.
For almost 20 years and two kids.
Yeah.
So I was like, thank you.
Right.
Yeah. Mucho gusto.
I don't think I can do 6 months lockdown in Chile, even though my heart wants to, but my brain is like, I probably shouldn't.
Did you have to connect through anywhere, or did you have a direct flight?
Puerto Morelos, I think.
Uh-huh.
So basically I had to take two buses down to there. That's where my flight came in, because I was like further south, and that reconnected. No, from Santiago, I think it went directly to San Francisco.
Okay.
And it was like the Twilight Zone coming back.
Yeah.
Because it was not the same country coming back that I left.
Right.
Everything
was just shut down.
It was like there was nothing.
Yeah.
It was like I got back to SFO and there's crickets.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what is going on?
And I'm sure like you came into Portland and there's no one on the streets.
It was just the strangest thing ever.
Yeah. That was so surreal.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, shall we hit up the trivia?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do the trivia. Harvey, why don't you take us away for our wonderful trivia hour?
Are you awake, Harvey?
Harvey's awake.
Harvey, wake up.
Okay. Now let's move on to trivia and comments. Trivia time. Trivia time. Hip, hip, hooray. Listener comments as well, handled the Life Stamps way, today and every day.
And thank you, Harvey. And here we are on to trivia. Ding, 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 ding. This is going to be between Joseph and Talbot.
Uh-oh.
And the first question is... How many years ahead is...
Wait, I'm just going to rewind you. Are you going to ask us both, and whoever answers gets the point?
Yeah, why doesn't whoever thinks they know the answer first make a little noise and be like, dang, dang.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dang. All right.
Yep.
All right, I have to think of my noise.
And if you...
Okay,
do, if
I got,
you,
I got or, my or noise.
Little finger?
Okay.
But
so make a noise.
Since we're on the radio, maybe make a noise.
All right, we'll make a noise.
Yeah, right. Just
ding ding.
And if you're both at the same time, then I'll try to figure out.
Tibetan bell.
Who came that would first.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah. Right. That.
Yeah. Kind of Jeopardy style.
Okay. All right, carry on.
How many?
Wait, if it's Jeopardy style, does it mean we have to answer the form of a question?
Yeah, yeah. No. That's fine.
Okay, so it's not Jeopardy style.
What does your mother, Alex?
I'm specifically talking about the buzzer, except for you guys are doing it with your mouth.
Okay.
That's all.
All right.
All right.
All right. Ready? Okay. Let's go.
How many years ahead is the Nepalese calendar?
What?
No noises to be heard.
Yeah.
All right.
We didn't cover this.
All right. 0 points for both of you guys.
That's a little bit of a
but me and you. But me and you covered this one time because we did talk about it over New Year's.
They're not on the Gregorian calendar, obviously.
That is true. And that's all. And you spent some time in the monasteries. I thought maybe you would know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember that part of class.
So,
I don't know. 3,000 years.
No. How many years ahead?
3,000.
No, it's only 56.
56.
But that means I think it's technically 2082 now.
Would you have known that if I asked you the same question and you hadn't looked it up?
I might have thought about it because we did do an episode about it.
I know. I'm vaguely remembering.
If you remember, maybe like season 4 or 3, I don't remember.
Okay.
Okay. Wacky stuff.
I'll stop giving you a hard time for the question. Next one.
How many of the world's 10 tallest peaks are in Nepal?
I think I just said it. Ding, ding. 6 out of 10.
You're close, actually, but that's not correct.
Is it 5 out of 10?
Boop, nope. Boop.
Because was there?
That's my noise.
Yeah, you go ahead.
Boop, boop. I'm gonna say 8 out of 10.
You actually just guessed it and got it right.
That's is it 8 out of 10?
It's 8 out of 10.
Or maybe I'm a good listener.
Yeah. Well, there's K2 and Pakistan's got a few.
I don't know if you even talked about it.
Okay. Yeah, but the top 10 in the world.
Yeah.
Nepal has 8 of the 10 tallest peaks in
six,
the world.
Yeah, 6 out of 10 were in the Annapurna area.
I take my bow, and this is where
there
I
There you go. It. Yeah.
Now.
Drop the mic, literally.
So Joseph's got a point. So 1-0. What is the big 5 in Nepal?
The Mount Ding Ding. The mountains that decline.
No, that is not correct.
The big 5?
Yeah.
Okay.
Boop, boop,
boop. Oh, what you got, Joseph?
Is it the 5 biggest yaks?
No, but you're close.
Is it a sporting store?
No. Right. What is that called? Is it called Big 5?
Yes. That's called here.
No, yeah. The Big 5 in Nepal refers to the 5 largest animals in the country.
Oh, and okay.
Number 1 being the Bengal tiger.
Uh-huh. All right.
Number 2 being the snow leopard.
Mm-hmm.
Number 3 being the red panda.
Uh-huh.
Number 4 being the one-horned rhino.
Uh-huh.
And number 5 being the Asian elephant.
I'm guessing this is not in order of biggest to smallest.
I don't think so, no. Okay. They just call it the big 5.
Okay.
And those are the big 5 largest mammals.
Yeah, that's the thing with Nepal, too. It's like I was up in the mountainous area. They have a lot of subtropical area, and they have a lot of tiger zones. I saw some documentary on the tiger zone, southwest Nepal. So it's a totally different world.
I'm surprised that yaks are smaller than a red panda.
Yeah.
I don't know. Red pandas are pretty
small. They're small.
Right?
They're kind of like the size of a dog.
So, I mean...
Are they big in the imagination of Nepali people?
Red, maybe. Uh-huh. Maybe the red pandas...
Or they're like important symbols.
Yeah, they pack their weight, maybe. I don't know. Like, mm-hmm. National pride.
They're cute.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, they are cute.
Yeah, I saw one when we went to the Panda Center in Sichuan in China, and my ex held a panda. Mm-hmm. Not a red panda, but a regular panda.
Oh, really?
She said it wasn't very soft. You think pandas are super soft
and
cuddly?
You think they'd be soft?
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
Well, the panda stuffed animals are.
I pet a panther cub one time. I was just thinking they were just gonna have this smooth, black fur and everything, but no, it was very coarse.
You said panther?
Wow. Yeah,
like the black panther.
A panther cub.
Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You think even as a cub too, they would have at least soft fur?
No. It was incredibly. It felt like
very
basic.
Coarse.
Uh-huh. It felt like petting straw.
Wow.
Yeah, that's kind of the pandas were like that too.
Yeah.
All right.
So,
what's next?
But we did talk about national pride here. So, this question kind of ties into that. What are some of the meanings of the Nepalese flag?
Oh, I think Poon Hill, like one of the best places to see the Himalayas on there. Also, Nepal is the largest, they're Hindu. So, and India is not officially a Hindu country.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So some symbols in the flag have to do with Hinduism.
Pretty sure. Yeah, it's not a Buddhist country per se, like Bhutan is, but but Nepal is not.
Right. Okay.
Because it's a triangle. It's like there's two triangles.
Wait. So Nepal, you said, is a Hindu country?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. I think so.
So you're right. So they chose to have two triangles and not just a rectangular banner.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bandera, because that symbolizes the actual Himalayas and the peaks of the country.
That's what
so
I thought.
So you get a point for that.
Okay.
And then
take what I can get.
Yeah. So you can get multiple points on this question if you want to continue. What you got?
No, I can't. Sorry, I would be cheating.
Oh, did you just look at
me? I haven't pulled up on my computer.
Every single week, Joseph, you have to just like try to pull up your laptop and Google.
I have to play fair because I'm like, playing with another contestant, so I have to be fair.
Yeah, you know, like me, you try to slip it in all the time and I catch you, and then I have to take your points away.
In the spirit of sportsmanship, I respectfully withdraw from this round.
All right. So
I'm Namaste.
So I'm going to give you a couple other things that I got. And I think what you were also alluding to with the Hinduism, the sun is in one triangle, the moon's in the other triangle. That represents longevity as a nation.
No.
As well as honoring the lowland topography and the mountainous topography.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So the sun goes to the lowlands and the moon goes to the highlands of the mountains.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's totally different than any other flag I've seen in the world.
It's very unique. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
I don't think any other country has a rectangular. It's like a double rectangular flag. Yeah, super interesting.
Yeah, it kind of looks like two like baseball pennants or something put together. And then the red represents bravery and the national flower, the rhododendron.
Oh, yeah. Rhododendrons are from the Himalayas. So.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it's 1-1. Let's see if we can get a tiebreaker or maybe both tie as winners. What meat is commonly eaten in Nepal?
Ding, ding.
What you got?
Yak.
I was gonna say that because I've ate a
lot.
Sure.
We have been yakking a lot, but you know, you could eat yak.
Yakky yak.
I'm not
right. I'm not correct.
The weird thing is, I don't actually have it, but I want to say you're right because one of my answers.
Okay.
Wait, do you got anything? See if you can make it a tie win.
I don't know, mutton.
You actually got it exactly. It was mutton.
Oh, really?
There are a lot of sheep.
And so I want to say you could technically make mutton out of yak as well.
No. Mutton is just is sheep meat.
Yeah,
sheep
okay. meat. Yeah. Okay, so mutton is correct.
Yeah.
Right.
And I got
mutton is adult sheep meat.
Yeah. Yak is technically not correct by what I got.
All right. No worries.
Yeah.
So does that mean I won?
2-1. Yeah.
Winner.
Out of sheer dumb luck.
Winner, mutton dinner.
So, well, good round of trivia. Thanks, nice Talbot, for coming in and telling us about an amazing experience, you know, life-changing experience from the sounds of it and stuff going through.
Thanks for inviting me. I love coming in. I love talking about travel, obviously. And Nepal is just a magical place. I started looking at all the pictures, getting prepped for this, and I'm like, you know what? I think I need to go back.
Yeah. I mean,
well, I can do it.
I need to go.
Yeah.
It
should be on everyone's. If you like the outdoors and you're into that kind of scene, like it should be on everyone's buckets list. It really is.
That's awesome.
Yeah, 100%. I think.
For sure.
I mean, I don't think there's landscapes like that anywhere else in the world, really, from what I've seen.
Yeah.
No, it's very unique, and the culture and the people. It's a total package.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for listening. This has been Life Stamp Stories from here and there on 90.7.
FM
Portland, KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. I don't know why I always mix up the thing. And if you are just tuning in or you came into this episode halfway through, we will be airing this episode on Spotify on Sunday. So you can just search for us there if you want to catch the whole thing. Until next time, happy travels.
Happy traveling. Thanks again, Talbot.
Yeah, thank you, Talbot.
Thank you.
Been listening to Life Stamps, stories from here and there on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. Join us in 2 weeks for our next episode. Until next time, happy traveling.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.